Hi, I'm Ben Rizzuto, wealth strategist at Janus Henderson Investors. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
Hong Kong ends its long-standing mask mandate. Plus, Marlboro maker Altria aims to buy e-cigarette startup Enjoy, and a student debt showdown reaches the U.S. Supreme Court.
Both the powers of Congress and of the executive are at stake because the Supreme Court has been saying that Congress has to be a lot more explicit about giving authority to the executive to do things.
It's Tuesday, February 28th. I'm Luke Vargas with the Wall Street Journal, and here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. After almost 3 years, Hong Kong has announced that it will scrap its mask mandate beginning on Wednesday. The removal of one of the world's longest-standing pandemic restrictions comes as the city tries to rebuild its image as an international financial center. Hong Kong has reopened its border with mainland China in recent weeks in a bid to reboot an economy that shrank 3.5% last year. The city was also affected by strict quarantine rules for arrivals that were only lifted in the fall. UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is in Belfast today to present details of a breakthrough deal reached yesterday between the UK and the European Union. Journal UK correspondent Max Colchester says the trade pact not only stands to end years of friction caused by Brexit, but could help to alleviate tensions in Northern Ireland.
After Brexit, the UK agreed to put a border within its own country to avoid putting a border between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and the Republic of Ireland, which is part of the European Union, to avoid inflaming sectarian tensions in that region. And so this is a compromise that's been hashed out that through very technical ways reduces the amount of checks, customs checks on products traveling from Britain into Northern Ireland, and also gives the Northern Irish Assembly some way to try and stop EU laws being basically implemented in Northern Ireland without their consent. But the aim here is really to reassure the unionists in Northern Ireland who are pro-UK that they're not being cut off from the rest of the country and that they should rejoin the Northern Irish Assembly of Stormont and put that back up and running again, which is seen as vital for maintaining the Good Friday Agreement, which brought peace back in 1998.
Canada has joined the US and Europe in banning the TikTok app from government-issued devices effective today. Canada's public service minister said that officials determined that the app, which is owned by Beijing-based ByteDance, quote, presents an unacceptable level of risk to privacy and security. A TikTok spokeswoman said that Canada blocked the app without contacting the company with questions. A government spokesperson declined to answer questions about whether officials tried to address concerns with TikTok prior to imposing the ban. We are exclusively reporting that Marlboro maker Altria is in advanced talks to buy e-cigarette startup Enjoy for at least $2.7 billion and plans to divest its stake in Juul. Journal editor Quinton Webb says those potential moves come as U.S. regulators reshape the e-cigarette market, sending tobacco companies jockeying for position to grab up pieces of the market.
What's interesting here is that Enjoy is one of the companies that's obtained clearance from the Food and Drug Administration to sell its flavored e-cigarettes in the US. And that's actually a hurdle that's eluded the two biggest brands, Juul itself and Vuse Alto, which is owned by another company, Reynolds American. Altria in 2017 had paid this huge amount for a stake in Juul, $12.8 billion, only to see that market leader's market share tumble. It is important to say, however, that Juul is not entirely out of the game. It still has a 26% market share in the US, and it is appealing an FDA ban that was introduced in June of last year.
And on deck for today, December's US home price index is due out this afternoon, while earnings updates are expected from Target, EV maker Rivian, and spaceflight company Virgin Galactic. Natural gas prices in U.S. futures markets have fallen by nearly two-thirds since mid-December, and this week they reached their lowest level since early in the pandemic in 2020. But those falling prices are now having an effect on private equity transactions within the gas industry. And WSJ Pro private equity reporter Luis Garcia joins us now with the details. Hey, Luis, break this down for us. What exactly is the deal-making outlook within the natural gas industry right now?
Hi, look, well, it's pretty much in a standstill now after gas prices dropped sharply at the beginning of the year. What happened is that buyers and sellers, they need some price stability to be able to agree on deal prices, on the value of assets. And, after gas prices dropped, they haven't stabilized yet. And that makes it very difficult for buyers and sellers to agree on asset prices, asset valuations.
And so is there a bit of a pileup now, firms that are trying to sell themselves or find a buyer but just can't close those deals?
Yeah, there are a lot of negotiations ongoing at the end of last year when gas prices were very high. That created a lot of excitement in the market and a lot of deals were getting ready to get done. But then gas prices suddenly collapsed and those deals didn't happen because buyers reduced their offers and sellers, you know, tried to stand their ground and they couldn't agree on deal prices.
In terms of numbers, the number of deals, the value of those deals, what are we talking about?
According to Rystad, which is an energy consulting firm, there are 15 oil and gas companies up for sale now in North America with a value of more than $40 billion.
I can't put that into perspective, but it does seem pretty high.
It is a lot. I mean, there's a lot of consolidation going on in the shale industry. Scale has become really important in the industry, and those large companies are trying to expand and to secure future inventory and gain market share. And there are so many private companies still available for acquisition in the market. So there's big competition for those that remain for sale.
That was WSJ Pro private equity reporter Luis Garcia. Luis, thank you.
Thank you, Luke. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we'll head to Washington, D.C., where the U.S. Supreme Court is about to hear oral arguments in a pair of major cases concerning President Biden's executive authority. That's after the break.
The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
A week after it heard oral arguments in a case with major implications for speech on the internet, the U.S. Supreme Court is today wading into yet another high-profile topic, as it's due to hear a pair of cases concerning the Biden administration's roughly $400 billion plan to forgive federal student debt for tens of millions of borrowers. Jess Braven is the Wall Street Journal's Supreme Court correspondent, and he joins me now to preview what is at stake in today's hearing. Hey, Jess, thanks for being with us.
Good morning to you, Luke.
Tell us briefly about these cases and what they revolve around.
Sure. Well, you know, one phenomenon we've seen under the past few administrations is that states controlled by the opposing party bring a lot of challenges to policies that that administration is implementing. And now we have Republican states attacking many policies of the Biden administration, arguing that the White House is exceeding its constitutional power. So that's the bigger picture of what is going on here. There are two cases specifically involving the president's plan to forgive student loan debt that you mentioned. One has been filed by six states, led by Nebraska, and the second was filed by two borrowers who say they should be entitled to even more debt relief than they qualify for under the plan as outlined by the Education Department.
And how are we expecting the government to argue in these cases?
Well, you know, the first issue in both cases is something called legal standing. To get into court, it can't just be because you don't like what someone else did. You have to be injured by it. And there are certain legal tests that demonstrate what an injury is for purposes of getting a lawsuit into court. Now, the lower courts allowed these cases to proceed, but the government disagrees and says that neither the states that are challenging the program nor the two individuals have legal standing because the government says they really haven't been injured by this program.
I mean, on the surface, it seems like these cases are really about just this one debt relief effort. And yet you write there is actually a lot more at stake here. How so?
Well, this comes down to what's known as separation of powers in constitutional law and the way that the U.S. federal government is structured. And in this instance, there is a statute known as the HEROES Act. That's an acronym for something, 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 something that was initially passed after 9/11 and later amended. And now it applies to all emergencies, and it gives the Secretary of Education the power to waive or modify student loan programs so that borrowers are not worse off financially because of an emergency. That is what the law says. And the question is what the government proposes to do to forgive up to $20,000 of debt for millions of borrowers. Is that within the scope of this authorization?
Am I right? President Biden initially resisted suggestions that he use executive authority to cancel student debt. And in the context of this, I mean, is the government now arguing that it has that executive authority?
Yes, the government is coming out and saying, we clearly have this executive authority. It's true that President Biden, I guess one of his characteristics or flaws as a politician is that he tends to be a bit more candid about what he's really thinking than many other politicians. But most legal scholars think the government's authority here is ambiguous, and he seemed to suggest that himself at a CNN town hall. However, after reviewing some research and legal memos by the Department of Justice, the White House counsel, and so forth, he concluded that actually the government did have that authority. And in a sense, both the powers of Congress and of the executive are at stake because the Supreme Court has been saying more and more that Congress has to be a lot more explicit about giving authority to the executive to do things that have major consequences. And Congress has a trouble doing that for lots of reasons. One, members of Congress tend not to be experts about policies. They're more generalists, so they tend to sort of give general instructions and leave it to the policymakers or executives to figure it out. And so Congress's ability to act that way is under question, as is the president's ability to kind of fill in those blanks. And that's sort of one of the larger issues going on with this student loan case.
And in our final seconds, Jess, do any recent decisions by the court maybe suggest where they might land on these questions?
Absolutely, because this court has been very skeptical of regulatory power under the Biden administration related in particular to the COVID pandemic, which is where we've seen many of the most aggressive steps the Biden administration took. The court really, through many of its emergency orders, shut down the administration's plan to extend a moratorium on evictions related to the pandemic. In an opinion, it voided the administration's plan to require large employers to test or have their employees vaccinated for COVID, threw that out as also being beyond the authority of the executive to fill in those blanks. So all the augurs, if you will, are not optimistic, are not promising for the Biden administration. Obviously, the Supreme Court can do what it wants, and there are specific reasons why it may or may not move in a different direction. But I think it's fair to say that the Biden administration has an uphill road.
That was Wall Street Journal Supreme Court correspondent Jess Braven. Jess, thank you as always for the update.
Luke, great talking with you.
And you can keep up with live updates from today's Supreme Court hearing on our live blog on WSJ.com. And finally, some automakers, including Ford and Tesla, have been dropping AM radio functionality from their newer EV models, citing electromagnetic interference from engines. But Wall Street Journal reporter Ryan Felton says that former emergency officials remain convinced that EVs still need AM, citing the old school technology's advantages when all else fails.
AM radio, as it turns out, is a vital tool to distributing messages from government officials. There's a number of AM radio stations which the government's invested in, about 75 of them. They cover 90% of the population. So these are stations that have been sort of fortified to be able to withstand more devastating situations. I think it's evident to everyone I spoke with that, yeah, there are other formats to do this sort of thing. But one of the former administrators I spoke to, he said not even 6 months after he got off the job, he found himself in the path of a hurricane and it knocked out power, cell service, and nothing was available other than his radio access. We have all this technology that we find convenient, but just having something as a last resort sort of thing, that's just the point that they're concerned about.
And we should note that AM isn't just for emergencies. An estimated 47 million people still listen to AM radio in the U.S., according to media tracking firm Nielsen. And that's What's News for Tuesday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.